I was renting this off-campus shoebox of a house. Two rooms, peeling paint, and creaky floors that groaned like an old man getting up too fast. But it was mine. Quiet, secluded, and just far enough from campus that most people didn't even know it existed. The semester had just hit its stride, which meant my nights were a blur of caffeine and textbooks. That particular night, it was just me, my notes, and the stray cat I'd picked up from behind the campus diner 2 days ago. Gray, skittish, hadn't even bothered naming him yet. He wouldn't shut up. First, he kept pacing, his little claws tapping rhythmically across the hardwood. Then, he parked himself in front of the bedroom closet and started yowling like someone had stepped on his tail. "Will you stop?" I muttered, flipping another page of my psych textbook. He didn't, just kept meowing, louder now, insistent. I tossed a pen at him, missed. He didn't even flinch. "Do you want in?" I sighed, standing. "Jesus, fine." I crossed the room and grabbed the closet door handle. Something didn't feel right. My skin prickled. That tiny pause before something tips. You know the feeling. Like your body knows something that your mind hasn't quite caught up to yet. I yanked the door open, and there he was. A man, sitting, knees hugged to his chest, wedged between a pile of winter coats and a shoebox of old term papers. We locked eyes, just long enough for me to register the raw panic in his expression. He didn't expect this. He lunged. I barely got out of the way as he shoved past me, knocking a lamp off the desk. He barreled through the hallway, didn't even bother with the front doorknob, just plowed through the screen like a charging bull. I heard the rip, the metallic clatter of the doorframe bending, and then silence. I didn't scream. I couldn't. My body had shut down everything but adrenaline. I grabbed my phone and dialed. 911, what's your emergency?
There was a man,
I whispered, finally finding my voice,
in my closet. He ran.
He's gone now, but he was inside my house. I saw his face. When the cops arrived, I gave a full description. He was in his late 30s, white, scruffy beard, scar above his eyebrow. I remembered that detail because his hand brushed against it when he pushed past me. They didn't say much, took my statement, asked a few standard questions. Anyone you know? A friend, maybe? No, never seen him before in my life. He wasn't just some random junkie or drifter looking to steal a laptop. He had been waiting. The next day, I got a call. They found him less than 10 blocks away, hiding in an abandoned auto shop. They had him in custody. That's when it all unraveled. He was wanted in two other states. Burglary, home invasion, sexual assault, serial. Same pattern every time. Stalk his target. Watch for days, sometimes weeks. Learn the routine. Break in. Wait in the closet or under the bed until the lights went out. Mask on, gloves on. He liked to watch them sleep before he did what he came for. Only this time, he miscalculated. This time, I had a cat. I didn't sleep for 3 days. I kept thinking about what could have happened, what almost did. The more I thought about it, the more things started to line up. The phone calls. 2 weeks ago, I started getting them. Always late at night. Block number. I'd answer, and there'd be nothing. Just breathing. Heavy. It wasn't just a prank. You know when someone's there, even if they aren't saying anything. One night, I shouted into the receiver, "Who the hell is this?" They hung up. I should have reported it. I didn't. I figured it was some dumb campus kids messing around. A hazing dare. Or worse, an ex trying to be cute. I had my suspicions, but no proof. I kept brushing it off. Now I knew better. I started backtracking everything. When I left the house. When I came home. Who might have seen me. I remembered a guy once, 2 weeks ago, standing by the laundromat near the bus stop. He didn't do anything. Didn't even move. Just stared.
Maybe it was him. Maybe he had been watching me that night. Maybe he knew my class schedule, knew I lived alone. He had waited in my closet for hours. If that cat hadn't gone berserk... I never liked cats, to be honest. Too independent, too smug. But this one had seen what I hadn't, felt it. The night after the arrest, I sat on the floor with him in my lap, still shaking. "You saved me," I whispered, stroking his fur. He purred, finally calm. I named him Bastion, like a guardian, like a wall between me and the dark. A week later, I packed up and moved. Couldn't stay there. Couldn't even look at that closet without flinching. Sometimes I think about what he would have done if I'd fallen asleep, if I hadn't gotten up, if I hadn't opened that closet. But mostly I think about Bastion, how he wouldn't stop meowing, how he kept warning me in the only way he knew how. People say animals have a sixth sense. I believe it now. He saw the danger before I did, and because of that, I'm still here. Always trust a cat. This story is based on a real-life experience shared by one of our subscribers. This is what she said. A relative of mine lived alone near campus and had been getting creepy, silent calls. One night, while studying, her new cat wouldn't stop meowing at the closet. Frustrated, she opened it and found a man hiding inside. He shoved past her and ran. She called the cops, described him clearly, and he was caught. He'd been stalking her, planning to attack once she fell asleep, just like his other victims. But the cat sensed him. Her ID put him in prison. Always trust the cat.
My mother was not a nice person. She never wanted a daughter. So she spent my entire childhood reminding me of how much of a burden I was. When I turned 23, I finally got my first real boyfriend. I was so convinced that no one could love me ever, so I never really allowed myself to date until I met John. John was everything I ever wanted in a man. He was kind and patient and very attractive. After a month together, we were totally in love. We kept asking when he could meet my mom, but I just wasn't ready for that. My relationship with John was the only good thing in my life, and I couldn't bear to let her ruin it. I told him all the horror stories, but he assured me that it would be okay. He loved me, and there was nothing that my mom could do to change his mind. Finally, I gave in. I invited my mom over for dinner, making her promise to behave herself. She said that she would. When she showed up right on time, she greeted me with a hug. She literally never hugged me before. Then she complimented my outfit and introduced herself to John. He looked shocked. This woman was nothing like the stories. I couldn't tell for sure, but it looked like he was doubting everything I told him. The dinner went really, really well, which made me angrier. I knew that my mother was up to something, that her politeness was yet another way to make me miserable. When she left, John told me what a wonderful woman she was. No, it's an act. She's not really like that. He gave me a look, and he definitely didn't believe me. For the next few months, we saw a lot more of my mother. Every time she acted kind and loving, she gave me compliments and told John all about the fond memories we had. She wasn't lying, per se, but she definitely left out all the bad parts. She talked about our vacation to California, but she didn't mention leaving me on the side of the road so she could gamble. She mentioned my fifth birthday party, but she didn't say that she burned all my new toys after everyone left. I tried to interject with the truth, but that just made me sound more petty. Eventually, I gave up and let her spin her web of lies in front of John. After months of this, Mom invited us over to her house for dinner. I really didn't want to go, but I knew that refusing would disappoint John. When she let us in, I saw how much her house had changed. It used to be a miserable place, but now it was spotless and colorful. She decorated the walls with religious paintings and motivational Bible quotes, even though she never stepped foot inside of a church. We prayed before dinner, which pissed me off. And when she told me how blessed she was to have such a wonderful daughter, I finally had enough. What the hell are you trying to do? Why are you acting like this? Mom clutched her heart, as if my outburst was giving her a heart attack. John held her shoulders to calm her down. As he was holding her, my mom looked right at me with a devious grin. I was too angry to speak. I had to leave the room and calm down. I was gone for 10 minutes. That was it. But when I came back, John still had his arms around my mother. She didn't look upset anymore. I don't know what I did wrong. I feel like I failed her, but it's not your fault. You're doing the best you can. I was watching from the hallway, so they didn't know. John was rubbing my mom's arms. My mom was biting her lip. And then she leaned forward and kissed him. I waited for John to push her away, but he didn't. He kissed her back. That was the moment I lost control. I didn't realize that it pulled the giant cross off the wall. I walked over, pushed my boyfriend away, and slammed the cross into my mother's head. "Stay away from him, you bitch!" John wrestled me to the floor and pulled the bloody cross out of my hands. John held me down with one arm while he called an ambulance. By the time we got to the hospital, my head was clear, and I realized what I had done. I attacked my own mother. I was going to jail. Even worse, I was going to lose John. The doctors were treating Mom's head injuries while John and I sat in the waiting room. He refused to even look at me. The police were on their way, but they didn't arrive yet. I tried to think of what to say, but my mind was blank. I felt terrible. Not for the attack, of course, but for letting my mom get to me. My cell phone interrupted the silence. We brought her purse with us. I grabbed it. Aunt Joyce was calling. All my life, she was just as mean as my mom. She didn't have any kids of her own, so she spent a lot of her time helping my mom torment me. John tried to stop me, but I answered the call. I put it on speaker. "Hey, Joyce." I was pretending to be my mother, and I guess it worked. Aunt Joyce fell for it. "How'd it go? Did you seduce him yet?" "What are you talking about?" She laughed like this was some big game. "Your daughter's idiot boyfriend. Please tell me they've broken up already." John's eyes widened. It had taken him a while, but he finally realized that all of this was because of my mom's twisted manipulation. At that moment, a policeman walked into the waiting room. I hung up on my aunt before she said anything. "Excuse me, you reported an attack. Would you like to give a statement?" "Yes, I saw the whole thing." John took a moment to think of his answer, but I dreaded what he was going to say. "My girlfriend's mother was attacked with a cross. I didn't recognize the attacker, but I believed it was her bookie." The cop took a bunch of notes as John told him the long story about my mom's gambling problem, all based on information I already told him. He lied about the attack, but not about the gambling. The cop seemed satisfied and left us alone. When we were alone, John apologized for not believing me. While Mom was on the operating table, we had a long conversation, both deciding that it was best if we broke up. He cheated and I flipped out. It was a mutual decision. I'm not sure what happened to my mom after that. I blocked her number as I was leaving the hospital, and I think she recovered. Sadly. This story is loosely inspired from a real-world event. On October 27, 2019, a violent incident unfolded in San Antonio, Texas. Police reported that a 25-year-old Christian Lydia Martinez returned home after drinking and began arguing with her 46-year-old mother. In a sudden rage, Martinez ripped a 10-inch wooden crucifix from the wall and repeatedly struck her mother over the head. The brutal attack left the victim with a fractured skull and several injuries. Martinez was arrested and charged with felony aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. She remains held in Bexar County Jail on a $30,000 bond as the community grappled with this shocking act. It was a week before Valentine's, and I was miserable. I hadn't been on a date in months, and I felt like a real loser. My only consolation was that Elena, who was also single, she had been dating our friend Charlie for almost a year, but he broke up with her a few weeks ago. She was totally blindsided by the breakup, and it took me a long time to calm her down. After school on Friday, Elena asked me if she could come over to my house. She had a great idea, but she wouldn't tell me what it was. I hated surprises, but because Elena was still in a fragile place, I agreed with going along with it. She showed up like an hour later. My parents were gone for the week, so we had the whole place to ourselves. She brought a cardboard box with a single word written on it: burn. Elena sat in the middle of my living room and waited for me to join her. Then she opened the box. "This is everything that Charlie gave me. We're going to burn it all." I hated that idea. Charlie broke her heart, but he was still a friend of mine. I'd known him since third grade. We hung out sometimes, but only when Elena wasn't around. I understood why she wanted to get rid of all of his presents, but this seemed a little dramatic. I tried to talk her out of it, but she wasn't having it. She was convinced that if we did this, it would clear out all the bad mojo haunting us, and then we'd both get new boyfriends before Valentine's Day. I know that sounds stupid, but Elena could be really convincing. I suggested that we do this on my dad's barbecue in the backyard, but she didn't want the neighbors to see us. She said that the fire could spread across the tile floor, and I stupidly believed her. She pulled a long lighter out of her purse and raised it up. "This is for Charlie. May your cheating ass burn in hell." I knew for a fact that Charlie never cheated on Elena. He just wasn't that kind of guy. With a crazed look in her eye, she lit the box on fire. I had expected her just to burn the objects inside, not set fire to the box itself. The fire spread across its edges, and then the whole thing erupted in a huge column of flame. Smoke filled the room. Cardboard shouldn't burn like this, unless Elena did something to the box. I jumped to my feet, choking on the smoke. Fire spread across the tile floor. Elena was wrong. I saw her through the smoke. She stood up and ran straight to the front door. Then she was gone. She left me. I didn't want to jump over the flames, so I rushed to the back door. It wouldn't open. Something was jamming it from the outside. I kept pushing, but it wouldn't budge. When I turned back around, the fire had spread across the entire living room. The house was burning down. I tried to scream, but the smoke filled my throat. Then I saw Elena on our back porch. She was standing outside the door, smiling at me through its window. "Let me out!" She reached for the handle, acting like she was going to help, but then she pulled her hands back. "I saw you and Charlie together, bitch. I know you're hooking up with him." That wasn't true. We hung out a couple times, but we weren't hooking up. I would never do that to Elena. I tried to explain, but she just waved at me with her fingers and disappeared in the night. By then, the air was unbreathable. Sweat coated my skin. I dropped down to my hands and knees where the air was clearer and crawled towards the garage. That was my best chance of escape. I was so focused on survival that I couldn't even think about how my best friend was trying to kill me. The walls were on fire now. All the furniture was too. I felt like I was inside an oven, minutes away from burning alive. Struggling to keep moving, I made it to the garage door. I reached up for the knob, but I was woozy. My hand kept missing. Finally, I grabbed it and twisted. The door opened in front of me. The fire hadn't spread into the garage yet, so the air inside was much cooler. I gasped in air and crawled through the door. There were three steps leading into the garage, and I tumbled down. I didn't have the balance or strength to take them one at a time. It was still hot in there. At least the air was clear. I used all my strength to stand and slammed my palm against the button on the wall. The garage door began to open. When I stumbled into the driveway, a fire truck was already arriving. One of the firefighters carried me towards the street while the others blasted the house with their hoses. The guy placed a nozzle on my face, giving me the oxygen I needed. As my breathing went back to normal, I watched the house burn to the ground. The fireman asked me what happened, and I told him everything. My best friend set the fire and trapped me inside. I gave him her full name and address. I guess the police called her in for questioning, but they let her go. She had an alibi. I didn't find out until days later that the alibi was Charlie. He came to see me at my aunt's house when I was staying. He looked nervous to be there, as if someone was watching him. I'm so sorry you're covered for her. Why? I can't tell you. She threatened me with something awful. You have no idea what she's capable of. I'm pretty sure I did. She was a total psycho. But Charlie was too afraid to admit the truth. He and Elena are back together now, just in time for Valentine's Day. They act happy around each other, but I always see the panic in his eyes. I'm still single, but it's not like I'll be allowed to go on any dates. My parents blame me for the fire, so I'm grounded until graduation. The only positive side in all this is that I finally know the truth about my friend. From now on, I'm going to stay far, far away. This story is loosely inspired from a real-world incident. In 2019, a fiery mishap unfolded in Lincoln, Nebraska. 19-year-old Ariana Chatel Lillard accidentally set her house ablaze while burning love letters from her ex. Using a butane torch, she tried to ignite the letters, but failure to do so left them smoldering on the carpet and went for a nap. Soon after, she woke to the sound of smoke alarms and the smell of burning carpet. Firefighters arrived quickly and contained the flames within minutes. The blaze caused $4,000 in damages. Though no injuries were reported, police cited Lillard for negligence burning after this unusual act of heartbreak. Ted and I have been best friends for years. We both had stable jobs and normal lives. If you met us, you'd think we were just two regular white guys with nothing interesting to say. You'd be wrong. Ted and I were thrill seekers. I started in college when we backpacked through South America and decided to sneak into some government buildings just to see if we could. We photocopied our asses and left before anyone caught us. It was a crazy experience. We loved the risk involved, so we decided to go on more little adventures over the years. I won't tell you all the stuff we did, as a lot was illegal. But basically, we worked our 9-to-5 jobs and had a normal group of friends, but went somewhere about once a month to do something crazy. A few months back, we heard about a satanic cult on some island in Lake Michigan. They gathered every full moon and supposedly performed magic spells. It sounded like a blast. I'd always wanted to try a little black magic. It took a while to track down someone from the group. Cults were very secretive. But finally, we found this guy named Paul. Like us, he seemed totally normal on the outside. We arranged a meeting at a coffee shop, where he asked us a ton of questions to make sure we weren't narcs. Once he was convinced, he gave us all the information we needed. To join our group, you must bring real human remains. A skull and some arm or leg bones. Meet us at this location and we'll let you join. He slid us a piece of paper with the coordinates to the meeting ground. He sounded pretty legit as he described all the spells they were planning to do that month. Ted was a little dubious, but I was convinced. That week, we snuck into a cemetery outside of town. It was a small place and it never had any visitors. We dug up a random gravesite and collected all the parts we needed. Ted did most of the digging work, so I had to open the coffin and tear off the head and limbs. I felt a bit queasy, but I plowed through. I chucked each piece out of the hole, and Ted collected everything in a duffel bag. Then I closed the coffin and we buried it together. Just to make sure the cult would take us, we collected parts of another body too. With everything stashed in the back of Ted's truck, we drove to the meeting spot. Because it was on the lake, we passed by a bunch of really nice houses. Some very rich people lived here. We parked a bit far from where we were supposed to meet, just in case things got weird. Then Ted and I carried the duffel bag together, and we walked past one of the nicest properties on the lake. It was a spooky night, and I was a little on edge. As we got closer, I felt something brushing my shoulder. It was one of the dead arms. I let out a little silent yelp before realizing that stupid Ted had pulled out one of the arms in the bag just to mess with me. I freaked out, accidentally dropping my side of the duffel bag. All the pieces spilled onto the ground, and thankfully no one heard me scream. What the hell, man? What? I didn't do anything. We wrestled around for a minute, but then gathered up all the pieces and continued to the meeting place. A dozen guys were there, dressed in robes and standing around a fire. Paul was among them. He stepped forward and introduced us to the group. Then he told us to throw our offerings into the fire. Ted fished out a skull and two arms and chucked them in. I pulled out a couple legs and an arm, but I couldn't find the second skull. The group didn't seem to notice, though. They just seemed surprised that we actually followed through with what they were asking. I didn't realize at the time, but the rest of the body parts were back where we dropped them, next to a big house. Whatever, it didn't seem to matter. The group leader did a chant. Then we danced around for a bit. I was expecting so much more. We'd supposed we'd just summon some good luck spirits or something, but I didn't feel any different. I was just starting to suspect that all of this was BS. Ted felt the same way. You want to just head out? We can go to Denny's. Let's wait. Give it a chance. Once Paul brought out a cooler of beers, I knew that this was BS. It was just some hangout group that needlessly needed to be morbid. I was glad I guess we tried it, but never again. We were still on the cult's email list, but we never respond. This all happened a couple months back. Ted and I moved on to other adventures since then, and we both kind of forgot about it. Then Ted forwarded me a link to a news article. It said that real human remains were discovered next to a summer home of an extremely famous pop star. The police searched the entire property, expecting to find more. You probably read about this. The news went viral, inspiring a bunch of conspiracy theories about this pop star murdering people and disposing the bodies. And the photo next to the article shows the exact same property we accidentally dropped the extra remains. The public will continue to spread rumors, but if you're listening to this, then you know the truth. The only reason those remains were found was because Ted and I wanted to go on some crazy adventure. This story was inspired from a real-life scenario. In May 2025, human remains were discovered near Taylor Swift's Rhode Island estate, famously known as the Holiday House. Police responded to a morning call in Watch Hill, where they found what appeared to be a human leg bone just two football fields away from the pop star's residence. The Rhode Island Medical Examiner's Office took charge of examining the remains, while local residents voiced safety concerns, calling the discovery deeply suspicious. Although police ruled out foul play, the community remained on edge. My parents died 12 years ago in an accident. I was a child then, too young to fully process the tragedy of their passing, but from what I heard, it was horrific. They had driven into another car at full speed. The car had been stationary on the side of the road, and the incident had been a total wreck for everybody involved, as the occupant of the car also died. The coroner reported that my mom's car brake had failed. The older I grew, the more I learned about the incident, but that initial hurt had been easy to get over as my grandparents had taken me in. I lived with them from that moment, never once missing Grandma's Christmas cookies as she insisted. I was always back home for it regardless of where I was. Grandpa, perhaps from old age, seemed to forget often that I was no longer the 5-year-old blonde-haired child that they had picked up from their daughter's home and raised. He gave me a duck doll for Christmas on the occasion that Rick came into our lives. There was no telling how long he stalked us, but when Grandma made a friend at the golf course with a man at least a decade younger than himself, we had no reason to suspect that he would be the terror that almost put a stop to Grandma's 12-year-old tradition. He had just moved into the neighborhood months prior, and he was a good golf player. His name was Eric, but Grandpa called him Rick because it sounded cool. Rick's hair was so blonde, it was snow white. He had neither a mustache nor beard, and he always maintained a clean appearance. Courteous and respectful, it wasn't long before Rick was a feature in Grandpa's daily routine. Grandma's only snag with Rick was the fact that he had no family. She never said it to him when he was around, but she seemed to have no problem cackling to everything he said. Grandpa's friendship with Rick blossomed so well that Grandma broke a rule on her Christmas tradition by inviting Rick to have dinner with us, as he had no family to spend it with. Rick was nice to bring a cake to the occasion, and he insisted that we eat from it as it was freshly made by his own hands. "Christmas spirit," he observed. The cake was made with good cheer. Grandpa dropped the cake at the table and offered to bring a knife to cut it up. The cake was opened up, and Grandma yelped at the table. Rick asked what was wrong and why everyone was suddenly staring at the cake instead of diving into it. "It's Luke here," Grandpa confessed and nodded at me. "The little one cannot have chocolate. Messes with his body." Rick's face turned sour. His lip hung loose, and I noticed that he was grinding his teeth strangely. It was the first time I had an eerie feeling about him, but for someone who was Grandpa's friend for months, it clouded my suspicion. "But hey, we can have the cake, and he will eat from the food that I made," Grandma offered in a bid to lighten the mood. Grandpa chuckled, but Rick did not. Grandpa asked Rick if he wanted some cake, and Rick said that he did not. It turned into a long conversation on cakes that I did not pay any attention to. Grandma said since everybody could not have the cake at the time, it was better to keep it in the freezer and eaten some other time, as it would be better than eating it when only Grandpa and herself could have it. It was in bad manners, and moreover, food was already set. "I'm sorry, I have to leave now." Rick gazed distractedly upon his wristwatch and was at once on his feet. Grandpa asked if there was a problem, and he said that there was none as he made his way to the door in a daze. It was a strange occurrence, and when I looked over at Grandma, I was sure I was not alone in my observation. Rick was out the door in a flash. Grandpa went after him, and then stopped at the door, turning about to face us.
"Something isn't right about Rick today," Grandpa observed as he ambled back to us. Grandma asked what it could possibly be, hinting at the fact that Rick may have felt sad from not having a family like us to spend his Christmas with. In her maternal way, she insisted she could speak with him and bring him to understand that we were also family, should he need one. "I'll call him on the phone," Grandma insisted, and at once she went straight to her cell phone. Grandpa said since we had to wait for Grandma's call for Rick for dinner, he'd be in the bathroom to take a leak. I watched the motions all play out vividly, because what followed was as unhinged as any horror flick could ever invent. Rick was suddenly back, and he was at the door with a butcher's blade in one hand, heavy and thick set, and a pistol in the other hand. He was sweaty, and his breathing was irregular. His eyes were glass set and unmoving, fixed on Grandma and I.
"Rick, are you okay?" Grandma asked, horrified as I was when Rick started to approach us.
"Your family took everything from me. Anna was special. The only treasure I had in this world." He recounted as tears streaked down sides of his face.
Your family butchered her in that accident. And now I have to be here. All alone while you, all of you, have each other to celebrate with. Oh no. Grandma moaned when it finally dawned on her that Rick was in our lives for a reason. Grandpa was not with us, and Rick noticed. His presence was so terrifying, I could barely breathe. My body was numb, like I was face to face with death itself. Where's George? You all should have just eaten the cake with me, and we would go and join our loved ones. Rick laughed in a crazy fit. He pulled the safety off his weapon. There was just enough poison in that cake to finish us off. But now, I don't care. I'll kill you two. And George when he comes, goddammit. Life flashed before our eyes, and I saw Grandma, in one last act of sacrifice, turn her body over mine to shield me from the bullet of our would-be killer. Her heart thudded in her chest, and I heard it echo off her body. She said that she was sorry, slobbering and crying as she spoke, fearing death. Then the gunshot reverberated through the entire house. Grandma twitched when the horrifying sound went off, and then she was stiff, unmoving. I wonder why he didn't speak to me about it like a man would, Grandpa said, and at once I felt breath waft into my nostrils as my body opened up in relief. George, Grandma cried and ran into the arms of her hero as Rick lay on the floor, dead from Grandpa's shot. An end to a terrifying Christmas evening. Call the cops, Luke. I knew something wasn't right with Rick today, Grandpa added as I called 911 to report the situation.